Recording has started.
Thank you, Patricia. Good morning, good afternoon to everyone on today's IRTTB PDP call on Tuesday, the 9th of February. We have Michaela Nalon, Boudouin Schaum, Barry Cobb, James Ladle, Kevin Erdman, Anil George, Barbara Steele, Michael Collins. From staff, we have Marika Konings, David Geiser, Olaf Nordling, and myself, Gisela Gruber-White. We have apologies from Tim Ruiz, and Mikey O'Connor will be joining us later. If I could also remind everyone, please to state their names before speaking. Thank you. Over to you, Michaela.
All right, thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. I hope you're all enjoying the spring. Bonjour. Bon après-midi.
Bonjour, oui. Merci.
On y a pas quoi? We can hold the meeting in French if you wish. I don't mind. It'll confuse the Americans. Sorry, Americans. One thing before we move further on. We got a reply from Tim Ruiz with regard to PDPs. So I think somebody was asking about whether certain parts of this PDP should be included in other PDPs, etc., etc., etc. So we do have a reply from the GNSO chair. The reason we split the IRTP review into multiple PDPs was to make it more manageable by breaking it into smaller chunks. If the IRTP, PDP, WG, oh my God, that's enough acronyms for one afternoon, finds that it may be efficient to deal with some tasks to assigned to other IRTP PDPs and is willing to do so, I personally encourage that. So, there you have it. So if there's stuff that is possibly assigned to future PDPs, the GNSO doesn't mind us looking at them in this particular PDP. And if anybody says PDP or IRTP, again, I'll kill you. Okay. Any questions on that? Any comments? Could somebody please put themselves on mute? I'm getting all sorts of interesting noises. Okay, that's stopped. No, it hasn't. Okay. Hello?
Michaela, I hear you.
Oh, you hear me. No, it's just, I was getting lots of noises of what sounded like somebody walking down a corridor. Okay, then. Does anybody Does anybody have any queries about that update from Tim? Is that clear for everybody? I'll take the silence to mean yes. Okay, then. So, on today's...
Kelly, this is James.
Yes, James, go ahead.
Oh, the noise is back. There was another part to James' message, which I think that was fairly clear, which was the question of whether a process for urgent return could be developed. And I think that the response from council was not only were we to answer that question, but also propose what that process should look like. So I think that was an open question yesterday that Tim also resolved from council.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry, I got completely lost in all the acronyms. So I kind of missed that part, but thank you for raising that. So the fast return, we should be in a position to make some kind of recommendation about that, in essence. Is that correct, James?
Well, the question that we posed to council was whether this was, and someone help me here if I'm misremembering this, but whether or not this was simply asking our position on this question or whether we were to go ahead and propose or design what that process might look like. I think that was something that we wanted clarification on.
Okay. All right. So I think what I'll do is just to make this manageable so my head doesn't explode. James, could you just lead into the next section, because as you were so good as to chair the meeting last week, could you just lead us into the next section that we were reviewing, please?
In fact, we were reviewing issue A, whether a process for urgent return should be developed. We started with the first comment by the registrar stakeholder group, and our discussion was fairly involved and continued on the list after the call. And while it may appear for transcription purposes that we never really got off of that first comment, in fact, many of the topics that we raised during our discussion occur later down in comments are echoed by other constituency statements.
Okay. So
I think we if we consider that particular topic, or at least the first element of that close, number one, then we can move to 1A, B, and C, and so forth.
Okay. So which one did we look at? So we're saying that the 1A we haven't looked at. Sorry, I'm getting confused here. We just looked at one.
Marika's got her hand up, but I think that, you know, we didn't really, we kind of jumped around a little bit. It wasn't a linear discussion, but I'll let Marika.
Okay, Marika, go ahead, please. Save me quickly.
Yeah, so this is Marika. So what I've done actually is to reorganize the comments listed on the issue A slightly to group all those together that actually spoke about, you know, linking to TDRP or the creation of a different process to the comments that we discussed, that James circulated, summarized the discussion of last week, which basically leaves one comment that was slightly separate from the TDRP discussion, which is the last one listed in this this section that we didn't specifically look at.
So that is the voluntary transfer of names in case of fraud, is that it?
Yes.
Marika?
Yes. The best
okay.
practices. Working group could discuss best practices for the voluntary transfer of names in case of fraud.
Okay, I was looking at this grid and I was getting confused as to what I was actually looking at, so this makes more sense. So the thing we have something written in is we've already done it, and the other one we haven't. Okay. Dealing with this, the working group should discuss best practices for the voluntary transfer of names in cases of fraud. Does anybody have any thoughts on that? James?
Yes, just a question for Marika. What was the difference between this one and the ones that's this comment and the ones that came before it? Is it the inclusion of best practices, or is that what distinguishes this from the others, or...?
Yes, this is Marika again. The other ones were specifically talking about either mentioning the TDRP or a process for urgent return that I think we discussed in the last call could be linked to the discussion we had on the TDRP and how that maybe, you know, might be adapted to address this issue. So the discussion of actual best practices wasn't something that we raised, if I remember correctly. So that's why this one was kept separate. But if anyone feels that any of the other comments that are now covered, you know, are all put together with in the same context of the TDRP discussion, please say so, and it's very easy to take those out and treat them separately.
But am I correct in assuming that, and this is James speaking again, am I correct in assuming that if we were to reach a consensus that the TDRP should be modified so that it fits the bill as an urgent return mechanism, then this particular comment should be obsoleted by that or superseded by that, because there's no need for best practices if we actually have an effective consensus policy that's covering this subject, right? Or maybe I'm getting too far ahead.
Well, I mean, just hypothesis. I could say as well, like the procedure could be, you know, in a escalation case, you might have best practices to try to resolve the return, you know, in a friendly way between registrars before you return to such a process. So there might be, you know, there might be a possibility to help discuss it in that context. But again, I mean, it might be, as you said, that if you come up with a new procedure, you might not need best practices on top of that.
Okay, thank you.
So does anybody have any input on voluntary transfer of names in case of fraud? I will just throw my one thought in here, which is the first question I'd ask, I suppose, is how do you decide that it is fraud? And how can you know that it is fraud? That's the first question I'd have. Yes, Marika.
Sorry, maybe I raised my hand too early because I still actually still have a comment to make on the previous discussion, the TDRP. So maybe you want to first finish the
thought. Go on.
One comment I wanted to make that actually another colleague pointed out to me on the discussions, why or whether registrants actually turn to ICANN for resolving of complaints or issues. And actually the survey that was done on the ICANN website, it was more to do with, do people like it? What is missing? Why do they use it? And actually that survey, although it was a small group, found that I think almost 50% of users of the website go to the website because they have a dispute or complaint and they're looking for a way to resolve it. So just to, provide some data around the discussion on registrants turning to ICANN for assistance or help.
And that was 50% of visitors go to ICANN because they have a problem?
From those surveys, so that covers, I don't think it's statistically valid, but I think out of a group of 280 people that responded to the survey, almost half of them indicated that they were coming to the website because they wanted to file a complaint or had a dispute that they wanted to resolve.
Okay. That's kind of disturbing. Anybody else have any thoughts or comments on that? Kevin.
Yeah, this is Kevin Erdman. I just wanted to sort of reiterate some of the stuff I brought up in the list and just look at it from the registrant's perspective, and I think that's an interesting statistic of how many people go to ICANN to resolve the dispute. I'm not sure if people know how to, direct dial into ICANN's general counsel office or exactly what they do on the website, but just from the perspective that I see it, from when a registrant has a problem, that is, they have one of their main domains that somehow got out of whack. It went to a different registry or had registrant information transferred that has caused one of their big domains to go offline or be redirected or whatever. They want to be able to be in control of the process or at least be able to manipulate it. And I think the reason in cases that I've been involved with that we're not dealing with the registrar, but just going directly to ICANN. Many times it's because the registrar that has the domain at the time the problem comes out isn't a registrar that the registrant has a relationship, or the prior registrant, let's say, had a relationship with, and two, that for whatever reason, the registrant doesn't feel that the registrar is, going to be adequately responsive to their needs. I mean, if they, the general management of domains, take a couple days.
Kevin, just one question here, just to clarify.
Yeah.
In this instance here, is the registrant contacting the registrar first, or are you going direct to ICANN first? I'm trying to understand this.
That I really don't know. You know, I speaking from the lawyer perspective, and particularly outside counsel, I don't always have direct access to the IT staff. And if a business person comes to me and says, fix this problem, I as the outside lawyer have absolutely zero leverage with the registrar, but I have some clout with ICANN. So therefore, that's where I would go. And
what, so even if you know which registrar is the sponsoring registrar of record for a domain name,
you go
to ICANN instead of going to the registrar. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah. Because, you know, the problem is that you don't have
I'm just trying to understand.
Typically it's a registrar that's not located in the United States.
Well, that's helpful. Thank you. I'm not located in the United States.
Yeah, because we can't see you right away, you know.
Beg your pardon?
I said, for a U.S. lawyer, he can't sue somebody that's hanging out in Ireland.
But why do you want to sue? Why do you? Okay, that doesn't make any sense to me either. You want to resolve an issue, but your first reaction is you want to sue somebody.
Well, that's the tool that the lawyer has.
No. My understanding is you're paid by your client to resolve an issue.
Yes.
But you're saying that instead of trying to resolve the issue, your instant reaction is you want to sue the registrar.
Well, what I'm saying is, no, the instant reaction isn't that I want to sue the registrar, but the reason that lawyers generally will have some clout with third parties is because there is that ability to sue somebody, to start a legal process. And from being a registrant's representative, the TDRP doesn't provide the opportunity for, you know, to act for the registrant, as opposed to, for instance, the UDRP, that if somebody over in, you know, Istanbul has a domain name that's infringing a client's trademark, I can't sue them in a U.S. court, but I can invoke, you know, the UDRP, file my complaint with WIPO, satisfy the client's needs. And if there's a case of, let's say, fraud, of a fraudulent transfer, and that the registrar is in the United States, I can send a nasty letter that says, you know, there's been this fraud case, you need to rectify it, here's why, and if you don't, we'll sue you, and that's the leverage. Whereas, if it's a registrar in Korea, if I send a letter like that, it will get no response. Because, you know, I, as a U.S. lawyer, they realize I have, you know, absolutely no ability to assess.
But hold on a second. Okay, but the thing is this. You're working on the basis that, it sounds to me like you're working on the basis that the registrar, that all the registrars are bad actors, which I find a bit odd. I mean, the fact that you could, I mean, if you sent me a proper legal letter, are you saying that I'm going to ignore it because I know that you're going to have difficulty suing me?
Well, yes.
That's fine.
Because generally, by the time a dispute has gotten to the lawyer's office, there has been some communication. You know, for instance, they'll say, oh, our IT guys have emailed this registrar, you know, three times and gotten no response, and it's been, you know, 18 hours now, and we've lost, you know, we've been offline for, you know, 2 days, and get this fixed. I mean, that's sort of the scenario that we're looking at.
James?
Yes, hi, this is James speaking. And a question for Kevin, and I'm guessing that perhaps the scenario you described, while I'm sure it's occurring, it may not be typical in that I think a registrant, especially an individual user or small business, may not initially engage the assistance of their lawyer, but instead try to work the problem out themselves, and they may and we would hope that they would reach out to the registrar first when they notice that something is wrong or domain has been hijacked or has been compromised, and perhaps so I think that if there were an effective policy for registrars or if there were an effective urgent return anti-hijacking tool, whatever we want to call it, we could mitigate the need for a lot of those folks to, you know, to escalate that to ICANN, and then possibly also provide a different tool that was a cross-jurisdictional tool for folks like yourselves. So when it does land on the attorney's desk, they don't have to you know, send out the nasty letters. They can actually invoke a particular proceeding to get that going. But again, all of this is not meant to imply that the registrant invokes the urgent return. It's the registrant that raises the issue with the registrar who's now losing a customer. And I think that if the process is effective, and it's certainly going to be attractive to registrars, and I believe they will pounce at that opportunity to save that client.
And I, this is Kevin Erdman again. I agree with those sentiments exactly, that it's not key that the registrant be involved, but it's key that the registrant has some mechanism that will, you know, allow them to feel that they have some control. You know, it may be something to the effect of if there's a form of you know, complaint with required supporting documentation that the registrar can put together, put in the hands of the registrar and say, here, this is the problem. This is, here's the mechanism to fix it. Go fix it. I think James is right that any decent registrar is going to say, hey, the client, you know, the customer wants this. I got this, you know, and they're right because they've given me all the stuff I need. Therefore, they'll, you know, invoke the procedure. And I think that's a good goal to try to develop.
Okay. Anybody else have anything to say on this? David, since I love picking on you, what's ICANN's staff and compliance view on this? In terms of, say, what Kevin was talking about registrars ignoring things.
From the contractual compliance point of view, you know, we would you know, certainly prefer that both a registrant, you know, and or its legal representative, you know, contact contractual compliance through the website, obviously to file a complaint, and then give us the opportunity to work with the registrar and with the counsel for the registrar to pass that information on to the registrar, and then to help facilitate, you know, some sort of review, investigation, some findings, and maybe a constructive conclusion, you know, short of you know, the time that will be wasted if you're not, you know, essentially communicating with the correct parties. So from our perspective, you know, perhaps there's a way to just better inform again and educate folks on our website on how registrants and their representatives ought to proceed in the event that they have, you know, complaints that aren't being resolved through ICANN, but more importantly, how to get complaints resolved through ICANN when it's necessary to involve ICANN in the process.
Okay. Anybody else have any thoughts on this? Okay. Should we move on then for next thing on the list? That was still TDRP, though, wasn't it? We haven't actually talked about fraud. Or have we? I don't think we have. nobody had any thoughts on that. Okay, so issue B, I think we're moving on to that. Whether additional provisions on ongoing inappropriate transfers are needed, especially with regard to disputes between a registrant and admin contact. The policy is clear that the registrant can overrule the AC, but how this is implemented is currently at the discretion of the registrar. So, does anybody have any comments or thoughts on that? Michael Collins.
Yes, I do have a comment, and I think that first I'd like to say that because the registrant isn't always disclosed, especially with some of the thin registries, the only way to really be able to determine if someone has the rights to a domain name is to ask them to approve a transfer to a different registrar. And there is an important industry of buying and selling domain names, and I think that it is important for us to be able to know, find some way to be able to identify whether someone has the right to sell a domain name. And if they can transfer it away, it's been commonly used as proof that they have this right. And if that transfer away can be reversed, it causes a problem. It causes a lack of confidence. And I'd like to be able to make sure that we consider a policy that would allow the registrant to overrule the admin contact, but only before the transfer occurs, not after. That's all.
Okay, thank you. Oh, so it's all gone crazy here now. Mikey?
Hello, it's Mikey. I'm on the call now. Sorry, I was late.
That's okay. I'm sure you'll make up for lost time. Don't worry.
I always aspire to live up to your aspirations, Michele.
And expectations.
I'm going to push back a little bit on Michael's position. I think it's true that the industry of buying and selling domain names is a big industry and has lots of needs, but I am not totally convinced that we need to completely bend over backwards to accommodate that industry. And it makes me nervous that the registrant might wind up being in a situation where they couldn't intervene after a transfer has taken place, because I think that's exactly the situation that Kevin was just talking about in the last one. It makes me edgy. That's all.
Michael Collins?
I guess there's another option that it would seem just as preferable to me, and that's to just end to discontinue allowing admin contacts to approve a transfer, that only a registrant could approve the transfer would be just equally acceptable. But we've already talked about the difficulty in gaining registrar acquiring the registrant email address, and I think that would be back to that problem again. That's all.
James?
Michael finished with exactly what I was going to say, so I'll lower my hand. In a thin registry, we would not have visibility to the registrant email address.
So basically what you're saying is that all our problems with IRTP and PDNR and all the other working groups would be solved if it wasn't a thin registry.
That's what I raised my hand to say, dang nabbit. This is Mikey.
Okay, Mikey, go ahead.
I'm done now. You said it first.
Okay. Right. Do we have anything more to say on Okay, there's a couple of comments here. Current policy is clear. The policy is not adhered to. ICANN should consider providing additional guidance in the form of an advisory. Recommendation to implement a consistent policy. James, go ahead.
No, I didn't want to interrupt you. Please continue.
No, I'm reading off something off the screen, James. It's perfectly okay to interrupt me. I actually welcome it.
Well, okay, then, with regard to the dispute between the admin contact and the registrant, have we decided or has it been established that the registrant does overrule the admin contact, so silence on the part of the registrant is assent to the transfer? Am I understanding the process correctly?
Silence on the part of the who is an assent to what? Sorry.
Since both the registrant and the admin contact can initiate the transfer or receive the form of authorization, but in cases where they do not concur, which is, I believe, the topic that we're on, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So in cases where the registrant and the admin contact do not agree to the transfer, either before or after the transfer actually taking place, has it been established either by policy or by procedure or practice that the registrant overrules the admin contact in those cases?
David?
Or is that the question we're being asked to examine?
Yeah, I think that's pretty clear. But, yeah, David, I think this is one for you, really.
Well, I thought that was part of the question we were being asked to review. But is there some additional background on that, James, that you need from staff?
It says that the policy is clear. The problem I think James has is that it's not clear, unless I misunderstood James.
Yeah, no, that's correct. It says the policy is clear that the registrant can overrule the admin contact, but how this is implemented. Okay, so I guess I'm just restating the problem in a different way. But what I'm getting at is that in many cases of transfer, let's say that where the transfer is initiated by the admin contact, the gaining and losing registrar are treating silence on the part of the registrant as agreement to the initiated transfer by the admin contact. Does that make any sense? So by not intervening, they are lending their agreement. And I think that's where possibly the security vulnerability comes into play, because they don't have to actively approve the transfer. They can passively approve the transfer.
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
So I think that that's possibly what we're getting at, and I'm speaking completely theoretically here because I certainly haven't thought of all the downstream implications of this, but one possibility would be requiring two forms of authorization, one from, the registrant and the admin contact. So this is kind of the analogy of the guys in the missile silo where they both have to turn their key at the same time or nothing happens. Something along those lines that would require the registrant to be more of an active participant in the transfer process.
Yeah, from a contractual compliance point of view, we would certainly support that. I think it would provide not only benefits for the registrant, but it would also facilitate our work in terms of being able to, to monitor and then intervene in some of the, disputes that are being, alleged or complained of, to ICANN. So it seems to make sense.
Well, again, I'm speaking in hypotheticals here because, I'm sure I have developers back in Iowa and Arizona that would pull their hair out if they listened to the transcript. So, but then another thought would be, and I just wanted to put this out here, we're talking in cases of fraud or security vulnerabilities, but really I would speculate that the most common occurrence of this is when a small business hires a web developer or an IT employee who registers names in their own name. The business is the registrant. The employee is the admin contact or vice versa. And then there's some sort of a separation. Either they quit, get fired, whatever. And then there's a dispute over who actually controls the registration. So I would say, you know, looking aside from outright fraud or theft on the secondary market and all those other things, they are important considerations. But I think the most common occurrence is when two people or two entities share a name and then part ways.
Okay, I have Mikey and then Michael in the queue. David, do you want to come back on James first?
No, let's go through the queue first.
Okay, Mikey.
Thanks, Michaela. This is Mikey. I just want to chime in support of James's idea because I think that it solves a whole bunch of problems. I'm quite delighted that he's signed up his developers in Iowa and Arizona to solve it. But I think that's a great approach to this, and also touches a little bit on PEDNR because that's one of the scenarios where post-expiration things tend to go off the rails. So just a nod in support from me.
Okay, Michael Collins? And Anil George?
Yeah, this is Anil. That sounds like a good idea. I'm just curious in terms of practice. Would you envision something where the registrant identifies itself by providing some type of email or letter from signed by an officer or an employee? I guess we should just think about that.
Yeah, and Neil, this is James. If I could respond, Michael.
Yeah, we're going.
Okay, and Neil, I honestly had not thought about that at all. But I was thinking that, you know, right now the current process does require a form of authorization, and usually that's the auth info code, and it's sent out to the same code is sent out to the registrant and the admin contact. And one possibility would be using something like public key cryptography, where two keys are sent out, one portion of the key sent to the registrant email address, one portion sent to the admin contact email address, and the registrar, the gaining registrar, has to assemble both parts of the keys. You know, the technical implications start to give me headaches, and I certainly don't want to go too far down the road. But just thinking in broad strokes, it seems like one of our problems is that admin contacts can initiate a transfer and run that process end-to-end without any involvement from the registrant, and that can either mean that the registrant is in agreement with it, which we've always interpreted that to be the case, or it can mean that they are completely unaware that this is occurring, and that's where we get into the issue of disputes and undues.
No, I think it's a wise idea to really think about. We should just make sure if the admin is the person who kind of handles the registration, that he or she is not involved in identifying the person who speaks for the registrant as well. So we just have to think about those issues.
That's an excellent point. Another problem that I could foresee besides all of the practical challenges with this would be that this does somewhat diminish the registrant's ability to unilaterally transfer the registration, which they can do now. The registrant, by current policy, is not subject to admin contact override, and in this model they would be. So that's another problem.
So I think for that, it should be if the admin is the person initiating, then the registrant should provide a key, so to speak, so that they're both consistent. But if the registrant is doing it on his or her own, then they shouldn't be required to probably have the admin provide a second key, I think.
Yeah, that's a possible approach, yep.
This is McKaylee.
Hello,
guys,
this is
you're
Michael.
Breaking guys, you're breaking EPP. That's all I'll say.
Hello.
Oh, that's just a technical problem.
That's just a technical problem.
How so, McKelly? I mean, you may be right. I'm not disputing that. I'm just how.
Well, I mean, it's just the problem. Like, I understand exactly where you're coming from, James, and I don't disagree with what you're saying in theory. The problem is that to kind of get into that kind of multiple key type scenario and assembly and all these other things would involve a huge reworking of how the entire EPP thing works at the moment, from my understanding of it. This is just from being the cat herder of the developers who run our back end. I mean, the other thing as well is, I hate to keep saying this, if the registry was thick, then it wouldn't be as much of an issue. It's with the thin registries, it's hard in a lot of cases just to get the email address, to get all the email address contacts, because they're not always all published, which causes problems. So, I mean, there's probably merits of it. I'm just a bit concerned about people getting too tied up on it.
Oh, yeah, we should discuss it in broad strokes and not necessarily do any coding on the call. That's kind of where I'm coming from.
Yeah, no, it's just because the thing I'm looking at is just like, it's the kind of thing that if I presented it to some of our programmers, or if you presented it to some of your programmers, they'd probably want to either A, lynch us, or B, they'd probably go off into the corner and just sob themselves to sleep or something. But that's just my take on it.
Most definitely, that would be the case. Now, if you pitched it to the customer service folks who continuously try to untangle these issues when they do arise, maybe you might get a little more support, but maybe not much more.
Well, yeah, it depends on how technical your customer support people are. I won't even get into that. Okay, can we move on to the next... what was this? Does anybody have any specific comments on any of the comments we received in this section? I mean, it's all down to the same basic topic regarding a conflict between the registrant and the admin contact. Does anybody disagree with any of the comments we've received? Is there anything that anybody wants to throw in there? Michael Collins.
Hi, I apologize. I may not be answering your exact request, but I was off the call for quite a while, so I missed a lot of what James and Mikey said. I missed all of what Mikey said and most of what James said. I apologize if I'm out of sequence here. But I did want to remind everyone that my recollection is that before the current IRTP policy, a domain transfer required the registrant to approve it at the losing registrar. And at the time, this was before we had Dave working on, at ICANN, I believe, and before we had a compliance team that I think is doing a much better job today. And when the IRTP rules were written, it was changed to allow the gaining registrar to do the approval, because so many losing registrars would just not, weren't performing. They weren't allowing registrants to transfer out. They weren't allowing them to approve a transfer. And it was quite a bit of a problem. And so I just wanted to remind people that I think today it might not be as big of a problem. We might have, we might be able to get compliance to allow this. But back in the day, there was a problem, and that's the reason for the current policy. That's all. I'm back online again, by the way. Thanks.
Okay. Chris Chaplow?
Hi there. Yeah, I just want to come in and just underline this point again from the point of view of small business, because that's sort of very much of the world that I see down here at sort of the far corner of the empire, as it were. Lots of small business setting up, web design companies coming and going, and I come across lots of cases where people have they've registered the domain. It's not necessarily been registered in their own name. It's been ended up, the registrant has been a web design company, but I know that's not quite the issue we've got at the moment. And I often say to people that come to me with a problem, if you bought a car, you would never let the number plate registration you'd never treat it in this way, you know. And so many small businesses, rightly or wrongly, do. They don't keep records of emails. They let accounts close down. It's just quite a mess the way people are cavalier about the ownership and the appointment of admin contacts on their domains. And from where I see it, it's a big problem.
Okay, Mikey.
This is Mikey. I'm responding to Michael's comments about the fact that the world may have changed since this policy was written, with the arrival of David and his team and a better functioning compliance organization. And I think that may be indeed the nub of the issue, that if we could understand whether the world has indeed changed enough to warrant switching back to the way it used to be, where the registrant at the losing registrar had to also approve the transfer. Maybe that's the core of the recommendation. And then sort of wave our hands at the technical details. Presumably, in thin registries, once upon a time, that was something that could be done, and maybe it can be reinstated.
Anybody? James?
Yeah, I just want to be the voice of extreme caution when we talk about going back to previous ones. While I completely agree that we have better compliance approach right now, there were a whole host of other issues that were involved in the previous methods. I think that the rule of unintended consequences definitely applies here, particularly when we're discussing things that have to be approved by a losing registrar. We have to assume that they won't. I would want to be very, very cautious when we talk about going back to a different method. I think if we're going to go that far and propose such radical changes to the policy, then we should possibly, take a look at it top to bottom. I believe Tim and some others a few years ago proposed an idea that was modeled, was called a push transfer. Which gave the registrar and admin contact the keys that they could then take anywhere. But I think when we talk about going back to the previous one, now we're talking about issues of how is it sold? Do they tack on the extra year to the expiration date to offset that sale? And all kinds of other issues now come into the table that I think are a little concerning.
Just on the push thing, so you'd be talking about something similar to the Nominet way. Is that what you're talking about?
If I knew more of the details, I would be able to answer that, Michele. But I just remember that there was a different approach that was ultimately not selected in favor of the model that we have today.
Okay. That's fine. All right. Anybody else have anything further to say that on this? Just going back to what Chris was saying about the small businesses, just for the record, James put up a great big green tick that he agreed with a lot of what he was saying, and I'd also say the same thing. Chris, we deal with very similar customer types as yourselves, and most of them haven't got a clue who's in charge of the domain, and that causes lots of pain and headaches and drives us all to drink, and I think James is probably agreeing for a similar reason. Okay.
Yeah, Chris here, and just to underline, part of what we think is not just the policy, it's going to have to be education as well, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. And this is James speaking. I just wanted to say I agree and really appreciate Chris's metaphor of the Department of Motor Vehicles and a license plate for a car, I mean, you certainly wouldn't put your mechanic's name on the title to your vehicle and not expect that to come back to haunt you at some point down the road. So I think that metaphor is something that really most people can relate to immediately.
The problem I have, and this is the one I can't seem to find a solution, and I don't think there is an easy one, is how on earth can we actually get this information to people in a manner so to actually do away with a lot of these headaches? I mean, how can we effectively do it? I mean, I can tell my clients, Chris can tell his clients, Barry could tell his, James could try and tell his. I mean, we can all try to tell our clients, but what can we actually do to get that kind of message out there? Mikey, not saying that you're going to have an answer for me, but you've got your hand up.
Yeah, I was going to say something very similar to that, and that is sort of just-in-time education notion. The other tricky bit to this is that scenario for the small business is that, in fact, the registrant, the true small business owner, very often isn't in any way involved in acquiring the domain. And so delivering education, you know, let's say that the scenario is that the web developer uses their own name as the registrant, so there's no way to find the true owner of the name. So it's almost, in the license plate analogy, it's almost as though it's a chauffeured vehicle that the passenger thinks they own, but in fact they don't.
It's a good analogy.
So someone said this one was easy.
Well, easy be no fun. James, you had your hand up.
Yeah,
you do have your hand up.
Yeah, just very quickly, and Mike, you're right on about that. And in some cases, we try to emphasize to folks that, you know, think about, besides your domain names, think about your customer lists, your financial information, or the keys to your office. You would expect to have some sort of arrangement where if you separated with an employee that you would get those back if you were to separate that relationship. And you should treat the domain name the same way. If an employee leaves and leaves their name associated with the registration, it's the same as if they kept the key to the building or made copies of all of your customer list. It's a similar concept. It has a similar potential for harm, and you should treat it, equivalently.
And Chris agrees with you. Okay, then. Now, I don't think I'm a strong believer in keeping these meetings as short and to the point as possible. Now, by my reckoning, we've got about 3 or 4 minutes left. Are there any other issues anybody wants to raise at this juncture? Now, notice Barry put something on the chat, which I thought was something which is kind of interesting. The idea maybe of ICANN sponsoring some kind of educational/learning videos on how transfers work. Any thoughts on that idea, guys? And girls?
This is Dave. Speaking from contractual compliance point of view, we would definitely support something like that in an effort to put things in plain English so that registrants have a better understanding of why we believe the policy is clear and how the policy is supposed to be applied and what happens when things go astray, so that registrants have a better understanding, quite frankly, of who to contact and how to resolve those issues if the gaining or losing registrar is not responding appropriately. So I think it's a good idea, and it's probably going to be, or should be, one of the recommendations coming out of the working group.
Thank you. Just before I go to you, James, have any of you seen the videos being produced by, I think it was Center did one, and Center did one on DNS, and one of the internet exchanges did one on how an internet exchange works, which was kind of aimed at normal people, between inverted commas. I don't know if any of you saw those. James.
Yes, Michele, and those are good videos. And I just wanted to, you know, reemphasize the idea that ICANN should there's a vacuum here, and that ICANN should step in to help educate the community. I realize it's a huge task, but you know, we have to start somewhere. I'd rather see that coming from ICANN than from contracted parties, because Michele, although you and I are very friendly on these calls, you know, in reality we are engaged in, you know, in a competitive marketplace, and I think that
it's called warfare, James. It's called warfare.
Exactly. So, you know, I think that if it were, I think ICANN in some cases, David, and forgive me for being so blunt, but I think that they have somewhat abdicated this responsibility to the contracted parties, who naturally have stepped in, and instead of necessarily putting together an unbiased educational effort, they have wrapped it in a marketing pitch. So I think that, you know, there is a role for ICANN to play in community education here. And in some respects, some of these roles can only be played by ICANN. So.
Yeah, this is Dave. I agree. And James, you are forgiven.
And James, don't forget, I do take pleasure in taking domains from your accreditation, and you know it. Marika.
Yeah, it is, Marika. I just wanted to mention that you know, we are in the process, at least from the policy department side, of setting up like an e-learning portal that I think will be integrated in the ICANN website. And I, for example, already recorded a podcast on the IRTP, but then more in the context of policy development. And I'm happy to take this idea back of doing something more about, like, okay, so how does the IRTP work? And maybe have something in combination with a couple of slides to explain to people how it works and what the different requirements are. And that might be something that can be built into that e-learning portal, and maybe might be used as well for some other policy areas or issues where we see that there are a lot of questions or lack of understanding from you know, registrant's perspective on some of these issues.
Marika, I mean, no offense, but I think what we're looking for really is something much, much, much simpler. I mean, the even using the term IRTP is beyond the grasp of most registrants. I mean, most people don't seem to know how domains work at all.
No, I understand, and it would be more like, how do you transfer your domain name, or how do you get, you know, how do you get from registrar A to registrar B? I mean, and obviously it wouldn't be a high level, what is IRTP, but more, I guess, straightforward. So what do you need to do if you want to transfer your domain name, and what are the obligations of your registrar, what are your responsibilities, and a more, I think what they're doing as well in the context of the RAA to try to make it, boil it more down on the basic points so it's easier to understand what you need to do in order to get it done, and what are the things a registrar is supposed to do, and which are the things that are not allowed, or where you have, you know, a ground to complain or you know, to work around certain issues.
James has the idea of hiring a firm, making it funny and viral, Dude, Where's My Domain, which I approve of. Mikey, and then Chris.
This is Mikey. I just wanted to chime in support of the idea of the education, but also raise the cautionary flag that a lot of what we're going to be educating about has wildly different processes depending on which registrar, which TLD, et cetera. And
thicker than,
yeah, you know, blah, 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 all that stuff in the Pedner thing that I did. So be careful.
Okay. Chris?
Yes, and we are doing something from the side of the communications work team and the new GNSO website, and there'll be a section in the new GNSO website called Basics, which I think Scott Pinzon's going to be authoring this sort of material, but really aimed at the layman, and I think you're possibly also doing some work with Marika on these podcasts. I'm not sure, but so there is movement, but I think it does certainly needs to happen at all levels. Thank you.
Okay. Okay, does anybody else have anything further to say? Chris? Is that from before?
Oh, yeah, from before. It's gone now.
That's all right. It's okay. It's okay. And for those of you who are into IP stuff, the Avatar DVD has been leaked onto BitTorrent already. How to upset IP lawyers on a conference call. If nobody has anything further, then I would suggest that we adjourn until next week, since we've gone just over an hour. Unless anybody wants to have anything else to throw in now? No? Okay, then. I'll take your silence to be agreement. Ow, my ear. And I'll speak to you all next week.
Bye.
Thanks, McKaylee.
Thanks.
Okay.
Bye. Thank you, everyone.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you. Bye.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.